Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
How formidable are the Taliban forces that we're confronting now?
Well, they're formidable. They're a bit disjointed at this point in time. The way the operation was conducted leaped over some of them. But there's tough fighting going on without question.
General David Petraeus on Meet the Press on Sunday with David Gregory as the first big offensive of the Obama troop surge continues in the Marja section of Afghanistan. My first guest today is a New York member of Congress who recently visited Afghanistan. Congressman Scott Murphy is a member of the Armed Services Committee. He represents the 20th District in New York. That's Senator Kirsten Gillibrand's old district when she was in the House, which kind of encircles Albany from Dutchess County and the Hudson Valley up north past Saratoga and Glens Falls all the way up there and out west past Schenectady. Congressman Murphy, welcome to WNYC.
Thanks, Brian. Good to be here.
And before we talk about Afghanistan, you know, as I was looking at the map of New York State this morning, I realized how truly strange your district is. It does not include Albany, but goes pretty far south of it. Dutchess County is about, you know, halfway down to here, north of it and way west of it. Why was it drawn like that?
Well, I think my district is indicative of so many districts all across the country that have been heavily gerrymandered. This has been a long process in this country of setting up districts to be, you know, primarily set up to be won by one party or the other. This was set up to be a Republican district, and Democrats have done the same thing. And it's one of the things that I think we could really do to improve our Congress would be if we would stop creating these districts that are custom-made for one party or the other and start tying our districts to communities. And I've actually joined in on some legislation to try to do that here in Congress because I think this is one of the things that's broken in our political system.
It's certainly one of the things adding to partisanship. If districts are drawn to be pretty much safe seats for Democrats or Republicans with huge concentrations of Democratic or Republican constituents, then people are just going to get polarized. But funny enough, your district is one of the exceptions because you just said it was drawn to be a Republican district, but Gillibrand is a Democrat. She broke through there, and you're a Democrat, and you managed to succeed her in a special election. So is your district particularly swing in the context of American politics?
Well, I think we've seen New York in general look more Democratic than Republican, and so I think that's something that's changed a little bit in the last 10 years, and that's part of why some of these districts are in play. And I really am an independent-minded person who, you know, was a successful small businessman, started several businesses, and I think that was something people were interested in, particularly in my election this year, as somebody who understood how we get our economy moving and was willing to look at it not from a partisan perspective, but just the same way we solve problems when you try to start a business. It's all hands on deck as opposed to wondering whether it's a Republican or a Democratic solution.
And we'll come back to jobs and domestic policy in a few minutes, but we invited you today because you went to Afghanistan. What were you hoping to see?
Well, you know, obviously, as part of the Armed Services Committee and representing my district, we're sending people into harm's way, and I thought it was important. I think it's important for everybody that's serving in Congress to get over and see what's going on the ground, get a sense of really what it's like in Afghanistan, and talk to the troops there, the soldiers, the sailors, the airmen, the Marines that are actually fighting, and also get a chance to talk to some of our partners, our international partners, and some of our partners in the Afghan government about what we're trying to do.
Did you go to Marja, where the NATO offensive is trying to rout the Taliban, or is that too dangerous for a political trip?
That was a little more, there's a lot more activity there. I think I asked about going over there, and they said they thought we might get a little bit in the way. So they sent us, we went to Kabul and to Kandahar.
So do you think that President Obama's surge this year, followed by the start of withdrawal next year, is a good plan?
I think it was amazing how uniform the response was as I talked to people across all the different communities, the military as well as all the civilian people there that are working on governance and development issues. Everybody understood what the mission was, felt like they had a clear mission, and the morale was very high. People were enthused about that. And one of the things that was a little bit not as exciting was just to hear how unenthused and kind of confused the mission had been for many years. People said we really didn't know what we were supposed to do until President Obama gave us this plan this year, and then General McChrystal has been outlining it. Now it's very clear that we're going in doing counterinsurgency work, trying to protect the population and provide services to them. And that's That's going to be critical to getting ourselves in a position to hand this over to our Afghan partners, which is something that we very much want to do, and they're very excited about taking over. But it's going to be, it's not a simple process to get from here to there, but it's something that everybody seems to have a very clear mission and clear understanding of where they're going, and I think that there's a chance for some success there.
Well, it was certainly confused and really kind of moribund and underfunded under President Bush, but is it not also somewhat confused today? I mean, what should we think about the basic contradiction of announcing a buildup for now with a promise to begin withdrawal in a year and a half? Does that present a problem for the mission? Doesn't that inform the enemy to lay low for a while and signal to the Afghan people that we're not there to stay?
I don't think it does at all, actually. I think that you do have the potential of the enemy saying, well, we'll just hide out and wait until you're gone. But what the president said clearly, what General McChrystal said to me when I met with him in Kabul last week, and Ambassador Eikenberry as well, is that we're going to begin withdrawing next summer, and we're going to pull down troops as we can. And, you know, somebody can lay low and say they're going to come back, but if they're going to wait for 2, 3, 4 years, the theory is, and I think it's reasonable, that if the local populace starts to see that the government's working and functioning over those 2 or 3 years, they're not going to be that interested in seeing the Taliban come back.
That's such a key in seeing that there's a functioning government that can stand on its own, because apparently a lot of people in Afghanistan, ordinary people, kind of choose up sides based on who they think is going to protect them or come kill them.
Absolutely. Well, this is the State Department, a retired State Department guy who was involved. I was in the local, what's called a PRT, the Provincial Reconstruction Team in the city of Kandahar, was explaining it to this way to me. If you're a local resident there in Kandahar and you've got a problem with government, the first place you go is to the Canadian or the American forces to get something worked out. And if you can't get justice there, you can't get hold of them, the second place you go is to a local warlord. The third stop would be to the Taliban, and the fourth stop is to the Afghan government. And that's how it works in Kandahar right now. So we've got to work with our Afghan partners and get that first stop to be the Afghan government. But the good news is they're not excited to go see the Taliban either. That's their third choice already, because they don't provide great opportunity. When the Taliban ran the country, there were 800,000 kids in school. Today there's 7 million kids in school. There was not a girl in school anywhere in the country. Now there's about a third of those students are girls. So people on the ground see that things can be better, and they're not excited about the Taliban. But in some places, in some areas, the Taliban are better than nothing, or they may be better than the local warlords.
Right.
And so, you know, our goal is to provide something in conjunction with our Afghan partners over the next year and a half that is clearly better than the Taliban alternative, and then transition ourselves away as our Afghan partners can continue to do that. And that's, I think it's a very reasonable plan from where we're sitting. We know that we've got to leave this place in a way that we don't have al-Qaeda forming up and running terrorist training camps there to attack us again. So the president's looking for a solution to that, and I think this is one that may well work.
Listeners, we can take a few questions for Democratic Congressman Scott Murphy from upstate New York, just back from Afghanistan. But you can also call about partisanship, which we touched on, maybe the jobs bill and the health bill. 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692. On what you were just saying, and of course, listeners, you can post to our comments page, WNYC.org, click on Brian Lehrer Show. I guess General McChrystal's system becomes really important, system of installing government, that he calls government in a box. You've heard that phrase? Apparently, after they take out the Taliban in an area, they try to install a non-Taliban government right away and hope it takes root. But there would be real questions, wouldn't there, about whether that kind of instant installed government can win popular trust and become effective quickly enough for the U.S. withdrawal to begin next year?
I talked to one of the things that's important for people to keep in mind. We've got a lot of our troops on the ground over there doing hard work. We've got a lot of civilians on the ground over there as well, and there weren't nearly enough a year ago even. And I talked to a number of the civilian personnel that are working with the Afghan government to try to get services up and running in these local areas, and it is not going to be simple. One of the biggest things that we can do is have these shuras or local meetings where we respect the local elders of the community and have them come together. Afghanistan has a fairly democratic tradition at the very local level in the villages, and if we can tap into that and use that that tradition, it makes it a lot easier to get the government up and running. And one of the things we've got to be very sensitive to, and I think General McChrystal and Ambassador Eikenberry are good on this, is that we don't step on this governing structures that were already there. Historically, we've done things like drilled a well and put it on the wrong guy's land, and you end up changing the power dynamic in the local community over how it worked previously. So we've got to be sensitive to those issues, and I think we are very much trying to do that, but it's not entirely starting from scratch. It's working within the local structure that's there and overlaying that with some help from the central government and from our forces to provide security and get things moving. So I think it's very possible, but it's not. None of this is going to happen overnight by any means.
So on this point, I think, Masood in Brooklyn. Masood, you're on WNYC. Thank you for calling.
Brian, this is the second time that you have information on our country, and I'm calling you, and I'm thanking you for taking my phone call. I do have a problem with the trips like this to congressmen. They do. They come up with this, what I call, positive idea without talking to the people in the ground. Number one, as long as you have a corrupted government in Kabul, you are not going to change anything in Afghanistan. That's rule number one. Rule number two, he made a couple of stats which is wrong. During the Russian invasion, we had more kids in a school than right now we have. We had less corruption at that time than we have. Even then, Russians were there and fighting with the same group that you guys were supporting in the mountains. You can check with the CIA stat. I don't need to make up these stories. It's all on the CIA stat. My problem with all this visit is they do not go to the root of the problem in Kabul right now. The reason we have this problem, you install during the Bush administration a corrupt government. You do not want to change it. And Afghan people will never believe until you change the complete government that is in the power.
Masood, tough and important question. Congressman Murphy.
Very good point. So I think I don't know exactly how many students were in school 30 years ago, but I do know that that Afghanistan was doing much better before what's been basically 30 years of civil war. And I think that what we saw when the Taliban were finally ousted was the bottom, hopefully, of those years and years of destruction. And so I think he's absolutely right that the country had come a long ways and had been hit very negatively. We're trying to move in the right direction, but we may not be back as far as they were even 30 years ago. And the corruption issue is a huge one, and it's one that we talked about a lot, and there's a lot of effort from the United States side to try to combat. The elections that were there this year, what I heard from various American personnel that had watched these things were these elections were by no means elections we would be proud of in the United States in terms of open and honest. But he said, relative to a lot of developing countries he's been in, these elections were pretty democratic and that there were an awful lot of people going to the polls and their votes were getting counted. And what we hear, what I heard so much over there is that an awful lot of Afghans on the ground actually do think there's some legitimacy to the government. They want the corruption combated, but they did feel like they got to be involved in selecting the government. And so Masood's right. We've got to get to a less corrupt government that people trust in Kabul, and that's a critical issue. And we've got to push on that front, and the Afghan people have to push on that front.
Masood, thank you for your call. My guest again, Democratic Congressman Scott Murphy from the 20th District, which surrounds Albany, used to be Kirsten Gillibrand's district before she got appointed to the Senate. And let me turn to domestic issues, Congressman. You're a member of the Blue Dog Democrats, generally a more fiscally conservative group of Democrats than many others. Senator Gillibrand was in that group, too, when she was in the House from your district. You voted against the original House version of the health reform bill, didn't you?
I did.
Because?
I didn't think that we did nearly enough to control costs. I've had, I think, the most town hall meetings of any member of Congress this year, 100 meetings talking to people around my district. And what I hear consistently is that we need to do health care reform. People want to see health care reform. But what they're most concerned about is finding ways to keep those costs from going out of control. And I didn't think that the first version in the House did enough. Today, we're going to be voting on a piece of health care reform. It's called antitrust legislation, or repealing the McCarran-Ferguson Act, which is intended here in the House to do just that, to force insurance companies to compete and hopefully hold down costs. And I think we're going to see that as a first step. And I know, obviously, you are well aware, Brian, the president's having his big summit on Thursday, and I'm very hopeful that we're going to see some bipartisanship come out of that with some support for doing what I think are the three critical things here on health care reform: getting everybody access to coverage, holding insurance companies accountable, and holding the line on costs and doing things that are going to change that that cost structure for us going forward, because we pay twice as much as any other industrialized country for our healthcare system right now, and we've got to get that under control. It's killing our families, it's killing our small businesses, and that's the focus, I think, that we need to be sure that we bring to our healthcare reform.
Well, the president wouldn't just need bipartisanship to get it through. He'll need that in the Senate. He'll need Democratic unity in the House. It passed the House by only 5 votes. Congressman Murtha has since died. One of the Democrats has become a Republican. I mean, there's no guarantee that the bill that the president proposed yesterday would even get through the House of Representatives. How do you feel today, as Blue Dog, or as just as yourself, about President Obama's version of health care reform that he released yesterday? Would you vote for that bill?
Well, we saw it yesterday. We're taking a look at it. And obviously, that was really a starting point for the discussion on Thursday. So as with all these 2,000-page bills, there's a lot of details to get into. But I think the president has a number of things that are very good on the cost containment front. He's been a strong supporter of having a process for implementing pilot programs and other things that we try with Medicare. One of the historical problems is that we try these pilot programs to save money at Medicare, and then they get stuck in congressional wrangling and never get rolled out nationwide. And he's been a strong supporter of something we call MedPAC to automatically roll those things out when they're successful. Another one of the initiatives that he's talking about that we saw more of in the Senate bill than in the House is incentives for people that are working to take care of their own health. I think it's critical that we enlist Americans in the effort to take care of themselves, and we've seen a lot of our companies that do these programs, these wellness-oriented programs, see real increases in people's health and real decreases in cost. But it requires some focus, and often it requires some financial incentive for people and say, hey, if you do the things that are going to keep your blood pressure and your cholesterol down, we'll give you some kind of discount on your health insurance. We didn't do that in the House bill. I think that's critical in the Senate bill, because we got to get all Americans working on our health issues. That's what I hear from doctors and hospitals, and it just makes sense. You end up with healthier people and lower costs for the whole system, those are the kinds of wins that we're all looking for. So I'm excited to work on this. It's something that's very important to people in my district, and it's a process that we've been obviously working on down here in Congress very hard, and I'm hopeful that we're going to see some more progress this week.
And guess what? Here is a caller who says he is from your district and he's angry about your vote on health reform. Paul, where in the 20th district do you live?
Hillsdale, New York.
Hillsdale, New York, along the Taconic.
Right, formerly of Manhattan.
Okay.
And I find myself in the New York metro area today, and I'm going to be demanding a primary. And I worked for Congressman Murphy at his Ghent office on the phones, and I think he's betrayed us and betrayed the president's agenda, and I'm sick and tired of people like that.
Is there a more liberal alternative? Is there a base of voters in the 20th district, in your opinion, Paul,
yes,
who could oust him from the left?
We in Columbia County put him over the top. We put Kirsten Gillibrand over the top. And we will defeat Congressman Murphy in a primary. If he wants to change, I will support him again. But what he said is not what we want. We want a public option. We want insurance companies to be prohibited from denying you if you have pre-existing condition. And we want costs controlled, which that bill did do, according to the Congressional Budget Office.
Paul, thank you very much. Congressman, how do you thread this needle in what you described as a Republican district when you also have disaffected Democrats like Paul?
Yeah, well, I appreciate Paul's help, and Paul should know that I'm a strong supporter of the public option. I talked about this at town hall meetings all across the district all through the summer and in August, as that was the big issue. I think a public option is a good choice for people. I don't think by itself it will solve all the problems, but I think it's helpful. It's something we have in the Capital Region, almost a similar thing in that we have two not-for-profit insurance companies, MVP
and CDPHP.
How about the
scoring of the bill as a deficit reducer by the Congressional Budget Office?
No,
but you don't seem to buy it.
No, that's not the issue. So there's a couple different questions out there, and people get confused when we talk about cost. My issue is figuring out how do we keep the cost of providing health insurance and health care to all of our public from going through the roof. That's where we're twice what the rest of the industrialized world is what per person, how much does it cost to take care of a person per year? That's different than the question of whether or not the budget for government spending on health care is going to go up or down, or whether the taxes we have in a bill pay for the costs in the bill. Those are government budget issues. My point is we want to reform the broken drivers in our system that drive costs here to be twice what they are in other places. We have a system where we encourage health care providers to order more tests and procedures because they get paid more money if they have more tests. Those incentives, as a small business person, I understand how that works. That's why we have dramatically more costs than other places in the world. We don't have incentives for people to take care of their own health and save money if they do. Those incentives matter. Incentives matter in systems, and I'm worried about the overall cost of the system, not whether or not the government has the taxes to pay for something, because those are totally different issues. What I'm worried about is the driver that drives costs up for everybody that, you know, when they're negotiating their contract as a teacher, that's the issue, is health care costs are going through the roof. When they're looking at their personal family budget and they realize they're going to pay another $50 a month this year for health care costs, that's the issue I'm worried about. It's the drivers of costs in the overall system, which have been going up 8, 10, 12% a year. We can't do that forever. We've got to change some of those incentives. And now is the time, because when we're adding the entitlement program that's going to get everybody covered, this is the time when we can make reform with our doctors, our hospitals, our pharmaceutical companies, our insurance companies. They're at the table negotiating. I think if we don't get it done right now, we'll never get them back at the table. Some people say to me, come back in 2 years, but they won't be at the table if we do the entitlement piece now without reforming the system.
And it'll be come back in 20 years. Just to go back for the last question, we have 30 seconds, to your role on the Armed Services Committee. Where are you on ending Don't Ask, Don't Tell?
I'm a strong supporter of ending Don't Ask, Don't Tell. It's something that I'm proud to be working with Senator Gillibrand on. It's a great step forward for us. It's past time for us to get this done. It's one of these things that militaries all over the world have dealt with successfully, and I was proud to hear Colin Powell come out and say that he thought it was time for us to do it here in the U.S., and I think that it's going to be a step forward for us.
Congressman Scott Murphy, Democrat from the 20th District in upstate New York, thanks so much for coming on with us.
Thanks, Brian.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC, coming up in a minute. An acorn by any other name, the embattled anti-poverty group is apparently closing down its old operations but opening new ones under new names. In the Brooklyn office, it's now called New York Communities for Change. We'll see if the new group can rebuild into a mighty oak tree of helping the poor once again, after conservative sting videos chopped down much of its funding. An acorn by any other name in a minute.